Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would one of history's most influential economists know about living the good life? Most of us who have read Adam Smith limited ourselves to The Wealth of Nations, the classic 1776 text that today lies at the foundation of classical economics. The book Smith published nearly 20 years earlier, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, is less familiar, but as my guest today discovered, it is full of sharp observations about how people behave and what makes life worth living. Russ Roberts is John and Jean Denault Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and host of the Econ Talk podcast. His new book is called Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. Russ, welcome to Think.
Good to be with you.
The theory of moral sentiments was a success in its day. Why has it not remained required reading in the way that The Wealth of Nations still is?
Well, Smith is known, as you pointed out, as an economist, and his contributions there were enormous in encouraging people to think really about much more broadly than just economics, about social science in general. But his first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, is really a work of philosophy. It has economics running through it. It has psychology running through it. But it's really written as Smith, the moral philosopher, was the author of that. And economists aren't interested in it. Its writing style is pretty archaic. It's a little bit Jane Austen-esque when it's going well, but other times it's a little bit convoluted and hard to follow. And it's not organized in a way that's very easy to read. If you just start it, it's pretty daunting. It sort of starts in midstream and you think, what's this about? So those are reasons I think the modern reader has never really grabbed onto it. But it's full of wonderful passages and it's full of deep insights.
And you thankfully have read it for us and have helped to divine some of the best insights. What convinced you, though, years into your own career as an economist to go into the back catalog of Smith's work?
Well, I always was a little embarrassed that I'd never read his other book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And I was interviewing Dan Klein of George Mason University. He'd come to me and he said, why don't we do a conversation about, for my podcast, on The Theory of Moral Sentiments? And I thought, this will be great. So get me to finally sit down and read the book. And I picked it up and I read the first page and I put it back down again. And I started to wonder, you know, maybe I'm not going to get through this and I should just cancel the interview. But I kept going. I pushed on ahead. And besides the fact that it really helped me understand my interactions with other people, I also felt, here's this great mind, one of the greatest minds of all time, Adam Smith, who for some bizarre reason is painted as the champion of greed and somehow the defender of greed and monetary motives. And he wrote this other book. It not just isn't about greed. It basically says greed's awful. And I thought, you know, it's really terrible that this person's legacy is a caricature of who he actually was. It's a caricature of who he is in The Wealth of Nations. But when you add in this other book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, you really have a distortion of what his view was. And I thought, you know, to be fair to him, it'd be nice that the world should understand he had a different, richer, full viewpoint.
What was Adam Smith's personal life like, by the way?
He had a very quiet life, which is intriguing given how interesting and sharp his insights and observations are. He never married. He lived with his mom most of his life. He was a teacher. The only real excitement in his life was around the middle when the Duke of Buccleuch hired him to tutor his son. And this really made Adam Smith was already doing quite well from the royalties of his book. But then this was a sort of a lifetime pension that the Duke gave him. And he took the son into Europe and he met Voltaire. And I don't know what else they did. I can't imagine how they filled their days and what their tutoring was actually like. I don't know anything about that. But then he came back to Scotland and England, and he hung out with really smart people like David Hume, the philosopher who was his best friend. And at the end of his life, of all things, he was a customs commissioner. He was worrying about smuggling and piracy into the United Kingdom and into Scotland. And that was his life. Not a very dynamic life, but he must have thought very carefully while he sat in those armchairs that he sat in musing in the 18th century, because his insights into economics and just really into human behavior and what makes us tick or really what's special.
One of your first surprising takeaways was that morality and the meaning of life have not changed as much as we might imagine over the past 2.5 centuries.
Correct. Human nature certainly hasn't changed. And so many of Smith's insights, which you'd think would be irrelevant, are incredibly timely. Just to take a couple, he has a lot of thoughtful things to say about celebrity. Well, we think we live in the age of celebrity with reality television and nonstop cable television coverage and the net. Smith, as some people realize, in 1759 didn't have those things. And yet he understood the urge that we have to get attention and acclaim. And as the fans of celebrity, how we can often be so romantic and how we idealize the lives of the rich and the famous and movie stars and rock stars. In his day, the people who were romanticized were typically royalty, dukes and queens and kings and princes and the nobility of England. And he looked at them with great disdain. He saw them as people who were constantly needing people to fawn over them and tell them how important they were. But what Smith understood that was at the heart of that, which is still incredibly applicable today, is that the way he phrases it, man naturally desires not only to be loved but to be lovely. We want to be loved, and by loved he didn't just mean romantic love. He meant paid attention to, honored, admired, respected. And we want to be lovely. We want to earn honor, respect, and admiration, and earn it honestly. And that hasn't changed. So he says we have different ways to be loved. If we want people to pay attention to us, we can be rich and people pay attention to the rich, or we can be famous, celebrity. People pay attention to celebrities, or we can be powerful, so people pay attention to politicians. And he says those are the wrong ways to be loved. The right way to be loved is to be wise and virtuous. And so he's constantly, again, strangely for an economist and the person who wrote a book called The Wealth of Nations, he's constantly counseling the reader not to be obsessed with money, not to be obsessed with gadgets, another area where he has timeless advice about how gadgets can become addictive. In his day, gadgets were ear pickers and a machine for cutting the nails, he calls it. His gadgets weren't the iPhone, but he still understood how we like beautiful objects and things that do their job well, even if they don't always make our lives better. But we get addicted and fascinated by them. And he basically says, don't be so ambitious to think that if you can get all these gadgets and things and all this attention, you're going to be happy. He says the way to be happy is to be wise and virtuous. If you're wise and virtuous, you'll be respected and honored and admired. You'll have a good reputation, and you'll be deeply satisfied with your life. You'll find real meaning. The other roots, wealth, power, and fame, they corrupt you. They're bad ideas. Stay away from them.
Smith was keenly aware of another phenomenon that we continue to struggle with in the modern world, and that is the tendency to focus more on our own suffering than what affects other people. For example, being more upset over the loss of the function of one of our fingers than to hear about a tragedy abroad that takes thousands of lives. How did he propose that we keep our natural solipsism in check, knowing that it is nearly impossible to extinguish that altogether?
Yeah, so in The Wealth of Nations, Smith's view of humanity is it's all about self-interest. And he doesn't mean selfish. He means self-interested. We put ourselves at the center of things. We're self-centered inevitably. And he was fascinated by this idea that despite the fact that we're clearly self-centered, clearly self-interested, self-focused, we do things for other people all the time. And he was curious as to why that would be. And the example you gave of the calamity in your finger was that he says if you hear that there's a terrible earthquake in China that kills thousands and thousands of people, millions of people, you're going to be horribly depressed for a minute. You're going to be sad. You're going to imagine all that suffering and turmoil. You might make a donation to charity. He says then you're going to go to sleep that night and you're going to forget about them, which unfortunately or not is usually what most of us do. He says, but if I told you that your little finger was going to be cut off tomorrow, you'd toss and turn all night worrying about that operation. And that's interesting in and of itself, but the next step is what makes Smith, I think, profound. He says, if that's true, if it's true that you care more emotionally, you have a stronger visceral reaction to losing your little finger than the death of millions of people overseas, why is it that if you could save your little finger by taking the lives of millions of people, you wouldn't think about it for a second? He said it would be a monstrous thought to think that to save your little finger would kill a bunch of people. He says, but why is that? because you've already revealed that you care more about your little finger than you do about the other people. So why is it that we restrain our natural self-centeredness, our natural self-interest so often in various cultural and social settings? And his answer is that we realize that if we put ourselves first, the rest of the world, which of course doesn't put us first, is going to look at us with disgust and disdain and horror. And they're going to say, well, what's wrong with that person putting himself in front of every other person? And so he argues that we have, when we're making decisions, moral decisions and social actions and social interactions, we act as if someone's watching us who's impartial. He calls this the impartial spectator. And the impartial spectator is really Smith's way of imagining and thinking about where our conscience comes from. He says it doesn't come from religion. It doesn't come from your parents, your upbringing. What it comes from is interacting with people and watching them approve and disapprove of your actions so that you learn what is socially acceptable and what is honored and what's dishonorable. So if you, God forbid, killed somebody to save your arm or to do something that was to make money for yourself, you're going to be so vilified by people around you that you internalize that and your own conscience tells you don't do that. And so what Smith gives us then through this idea of an impartial spectator is a way to achieve what modern psychology calls mindfulness, a way to step outside yourself and say, wait a minute. I'm working myself into an incredible rage over some slight at work or over some inconvenience that happens to me on my commute or some family member did something that really annoyed me. You know, if I could step back, how would somebody who's not me look at this situation from the outside who doesn't have a stake in it? And they're going to say, well, what's wrong with that guy? Boy, he's out of control. And if you can do that to yourself before you make the angry remark or the blow up, you really have a way to become a better person. And I argue in my book, that Smith's giving us a way to improve ourselves. And Smith is, of course, very aware that because we want to be lovely, we often fool ourselves into thinking we're lovely. And he's reminding us that it's much better to step back and see yourself closer to as you really are and not as how you'd like to be.
Which, of course, can be a painful thing. And Smith was aware that we find it so easy to justify things we've done wrong based on a lot of things. But it is true that if you think about, you know, someone that you have in your life that you want to respect you, the standards change a lot.
Yeah. And ideally, that's your spouse, your parents, your best friends. Those are the people whose respect you really do want to earn and earn honestly, not by deceiving them or fooling them or, you know, doing things that you shouldn't get credit for, but taking credit for them. And Smith is just incredibly critical of people who are constantly fooling themselves or worse, fooling others about what their achievements are or their behavior. And he says, one of my favorite lines in the book, he says, bold is the surgeon whose hand does not tremble when he operates upon himself. So we're really good at seeing other people's faults. You know, I could do. You need some help? You know, I can diagnose your problems. I can fix them. I got the cure. My own problem? Well, you know, I really don't have any flaws is the way Smith sees us looking at ourselves. And he says we wear the mysterious veil of self-delusion. And that mysterious veil, it keeps our deformities, he calls them, and by deformities he means our moral failings and our imperfections. That keeps them from the world. We hide those. But Smith was also saying we hide them from ourselves. We don't want to see ourselves as we truly are.
We're speaking this hour with Russ Roberts. He is host of the Econ Talk podcast and author of the new book, Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Russ Roberts. He's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, host of the Econ Talk podcast, and author of the new book, Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Russ, Adam Smith was a guy who was invested in trying to do the right thing, even when it's not easy. He was no starry-eyed optimist, though. He did not, in fact, believe we really can love our neighbor as we love ourselves. The best he could do, we could do, he thought, was to act like we did.
Yeah, he's very subtle in his understandings of how well we can get along with people. He uses a lot of examples of tragedy. You know, there was a lot more tragedy in life in 1759 than there is today in at least parts of the world. And he focused on that to a large extent in the book, how we deal with loss and death. And we can – of course, we still have death, but, and we also have loss at work and people lose their jobs. And we have all kinds of small and large tragedies in our lives. And what he says is – he says you really can't put yourself in the shoes of another person. You can't – feel their pain literally. You can't feel it as much as the person who's going through the ordeal. He says, but you can imagine it in various ways. And the amount you can imagine depends on the nature of the loss. And it also depends on how close you are to the person. So what he says is that let's say you've suffered a loss and you're talking to a relative stranger, somebody you're not close to. You know that person can't feel your pain the way you'd feel it. So you soften your grief, he says. And that other person tries to get close, but they can't quite get there because they're a stranger and they haven't gone what you've gone through. And he describes this as sort of a musical, almost a dance, almost a harmonizing attempt that because we're separate people, because we are not we can't imagine what everyone else is going through. We're isolated inevitably in the human condition. He says we do the best we can. And often he says that's good enough. And he says something very striking. He says, you know, if you're talking to a close friend about a tragedy, because you know that friend can feel it fairly closely to your own loss, you'll show more of that loss. He says, but when you're talking to the stranger, you'll soften it and it'll actually make you feel better because talking to the stranger is going to force you to be more normal. The example I give in my book is that you can be in a fight with your spouse. You can be yelling or with somebody at work in a very emotional mood, and your cell phone will ring. And you shouldn't
Hello?
Answer it usually. Usually you shouldn't answer it in the middle of an argument. But sometimes you've promised something, and you answer it in this totally normal voice, different from the one you've been arguing with. Yeah, it's, hello. And how is that? And that shows you that you're capable of controlling your emotions if you want to. And a lot of times, you know, we work ourselves into a state. We get all worked up over some indignity or injustice. And Smith is telling us that when we talk to people who are less close to us, we actually can often get more comfort from them than we might otherwise, or at least not so much comfort, but we can get into a better mood. We can soften our own grief. So he spends a lot of time talking about that. And he talks about success as well. He doesn't just deal with tragedy. He says, you know, a great success – he says, no one's really going to be that happy for you. A small success, yeah. He says, people like joy. Joy's fine. They see something nice for you. They're happy. But if you win the lottery, he says their praise is probably not going to be quite as sincere as it might appear and their congratulations. And I quote Gore Vidal, who said it a little better. He says, every time one of my friends succeeds, I die a little. That's a kind of an unfortunate view of human nature, but there's some truth to it, of course. Ideally, we celebrate with our friends. We want them to succeed. But Smith's point was that great success, we do not share in the same way with a friend as we do a great tragedy. A great tragedy says your friends will be very empathetic for you and they will do their best to give you comfort. A great success, yeah, they won't be so happy for you. A small success, they're happy for you. A small tragedy, what he called a small vexation, he says, better keep that to yourself. Don't be a whiner. He didn't use that word, but that's what he meant. Don't whine and complain about little things. He says most people won't feel sorry for you. And he gives this amazing example of 1759. He says, you know, if your mistress jilts you, he says, don't look for pity and sympathy. He says, just make a joke out of it. And I think times have changed a lot. I don't have that many of my colleagues complaining about their mistresses jilting them over the weekend. But in Smith's day, I guess that was water cooler conversation. And his point, which is correct, is that when you have that kind of misadventure, he says, you're better off making a joke out of it because other people will find it amusing. They won't feel sorry for you.
What is interesting about that, of all the things in the book, this idea of sort of tempering your expression of your own sorrows and tragedy is probably the least modern thing about this book. And in some ways, it's the most refreshing, right? These days, we have this idea that if you have experienced something horrible, the world should revolve around your grief and there's no expression of it that is too strong. And you know, psychologically, I think we can all understand how many people arrived at that. But the idea that there actually is value to the person suffering in finding a way to sort of move on with this thing makes perfect sense, especially if you take, you know, the world that Smith lived in where, you know, people could be perfectly fine and 3 days later be dead of some raging infection.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we look at keeping your emotions in as repressive. Smith didn't see it that way. He lived in a very different era. But you raised the right point, which is maybe we have something to learn here that going around and expressing yourself as a victim all the time maybe isn't the healthiest thing or the best thing. Smith lived in a very dignified time, right? He's in Scotland in the middle and end of the 18th century. And you think of the British gentleman with the stiff upper lip who muddles through and maintains his poise even when the world's fallen apart around him. That really was his ideal. It's you still find it in Kipling's poem, If. Mm-hmm. Keep your head about you and all those about you are losing theirs. That's a very Smithian idea. Smith also has a lot of influence from the Stoics. You know, he really wants you to deal with great equanimity with emotional turmoil. And that's hard for us. In our age, it encourages a very different set of responses. We're supposed to wear our hearts on our sleeves, express ourselves, get it out. And Smith counseled otherwise. I don't know if he'd feel that way today, but it's an interesting perspective for sure.
How did Smith suggest we steel ourselves against being influenced by false praise or flattery, particularly when so often anybody else could recognize that as false praise or flattery, but to us it feels perfectly true and earned?
Well, I like his phrase, man naturally desires not only to be loved but to be lovely. And when you realize that about yourself and about other people, that we're looking for respect and honor and admiration, we can insulate ourselves a little bit from the false compliment. I find it fascinating how when somebody gives me a compliment that I know is just – it's just small talk, right? It's just being polite. Someone says something nice about you, about maybe what you're wearing or something you said or something you did at work. And even when you're aware of it, you find yourself warming inside toward the person who gives you the compliment. So it gives you a little bit of it gives you a way to step back a little bit, be that impartial spectator and think, gee, did I really earn that or is that flattery? And that's designed to get something. And you know, I give the example in the book of the guy who becomes the head of a large foundation and somebody says, congratulations, you'll never get an honest compliment. You'll never pay for a dinner now that you're this person who hands out money. People who hand out money and rich people generally have a lot of friends. Some of them aren't sincere. They're people who like being around folks who hand out money and think that maybe some of it will fall on them. And so Smith is warning us about the fact that we're susceptible to false praise. We're susceptible to flattery. And Smith's this crazy person. He's got such high standards for himself. He's very he's just so disgusted by people who flatter other people or who are fooled by flattery. He's shocked that people – he's not shocked, but he's disgusted and critical of people who get compliments for things they didn't do. And he says, you know, it should be doubly horrifying. Not only did you not do what you're getting credit for, but you missed the chance to do this good thing and you didn't do it. And he says, you know, a good person, a virtuous person will take that as a double criticism, not as, oh, I got away with it. Somebody thought I did something great. And he has nothing but disgust for those kind of people who are constantly taking credit for stuff they didn't do.
I don't remember seeing this in your book, but, you know, of course, we should be on the lookout for false praise as it affects us. We all also know that person, right, who gets a compliment from anywhere and then has to trumpet it and broadcast it like someone said this great thing about me and it just felt so good.
Me.
How do you think that person, how should we deal with people who do that? We don't want to, you know, pop their balloon. On the other hand, it gets a little irritating.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite things in the book is where Smith, he talks about what he calls the quackish arts, the way that people, this again, 1759, the way that people, so before Facebook and Twitter and people doing horrific things to get on TV for their 15 minutes of fame, but the quackish arts were ways that people used to attract attention to themselves, and he knew how much we like attention. There weren't as many ways to get it in 1759. There wasn't cable TV and social media. But he understood this temptation we have. And he just he's very judgmental about it. And he counsels us, the reader, against it, that it's a bad idea. It's degrading. You know, I see you see this on the web all the time, people who will retweet nice things about themselves because, well, I'm not saying, I'm just retweeting it. And, you know, I've done it myself. It's not it's a human natural thing to do. But I think what Smith's warning is about is that that's a little bit degrading, first of all, if you're not careful. And second of all, you don't have to brag about yourself all the time. It's good. I quote, I can't remember, but it's dignified to not have to talk about yourself all the time. As tempting as it is, you know, it's the old enough about me. Let's talk about what you think about me.
Right.
and that's, you know, that's a person who's got a two-way street for conversation. And I think we have to be careful about that. It's a nice warning that's not so nice.
He didn't, of course, have children himself, but I wonder what he would think about the modern standard of so much praise just sort of simply for existing that we give kids today.
Yeah, I don't think he'd be so pleased with the self-esteem movement and the implication that if we don't praise kids, they won't do very well. In fact, he probably would have gone the other way. Despite the fact that he didn't have any children, he, of course, was a child. He was the son of his mom who he loved. And he had a lot of – I didn't get all this into the book, but in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he talks a little bit about parenting and he makes the observation that the Bible does not say love your parents. It says honor them. And he understood that it's easier for parents to love their children than for children to love their parents. So he's very, I think, aware of some of the challenges of parenting. And I think he would have had some interesting insights into the way that I think parents today sometimes want to be friends with their kids rather than raise them and teach them some stuff. So I think he would have not been so keen on some of the modern child raising practices.
How did Smith define taking care of oneself, and why did he see that as such an important thing to do in order to live a good life?
So, you know, we talked earlier, you said, you know, we all want to be loved. We want people to honor us, respect us, admire us, talk about us, pay attention to us. And he says there's two ways to get there. One is this bad path, this follow your ambition and try to accumulate wealth and fame and power. He says that's a bad path. Don't go there. Try to avoid it. He says most people, they go that way, end up damaged and unhappy and miserable. And they also really get addicted to praise and attention, and that's not healthy. He suggests taking the quieter route. He says, you know, be wise and be virtuous. And when you think about what virtue is, well, you think, oh, it's easy. Let's be a nice person. But it's not so easy. And Smith spends a lot of time talking about how to be virtuous and how it's not so obvious. And he really focuses on three virtues. He focuses on prudence, justice, and benevolence. So prudence is take care of yourself. Don't be reckless. Don't be a spendthrift. Don't invest in high-risk investments. You know, take care of your body. Take care of your money. He doesn't talk about it in his day, of course, but I think he would have been a fan of going to the gym now and then, if not often, eating carefully and not overindulging in carbohydrates and unhealthy foods. And that's prudence. So take care of yourself. That's a minimum. That's a minimum thing. Justice was don't hurt other people. That one's black and white, he says. He says it's like the rules of grammar. We know what's good grammar and what's not. We know what's you don't steal, you don't beat people up, etc. He says, but the rules of beneficence, which is being nice to other people, he says They're like the rules of composition. They're not like the rules of grammar. The rules of grammar are black and white, but the rules of composition, he says, are loose, vague, and indeterminate. So he spends quite a bit of time trying to talk about what's true beneficence. He talks about gratitude. He talks about helping other people. And that's, of course, a big challenge because Smith doesn't say you should try to help other people. He says you should actually help other people. And a lot of what we do, I think, is you know, window dressing. It's trying to make ourselves look virtuous rather than actually virtuous. And what Smith actually cared about was results, not just looking good but doing good. And that, I think, is very difficult and it's very important. And so that, I think, Smith's advice there is very, very useful in thinking about how we interact with other people. I think often we think, oh, I'm a good person. And, you know, I give examples in the book of people, you know, when you have a chance to comfort someone at a funeral or to do something that requires a sacrifice on your part, how challenging it is, how easy it is to think up reasons of not why you don't have to go, but to go and to actually do the right thing is very challenging. And it's easy to say, well, you know, I'm a nice person. I'm basically good. Well, that's not Smith's standard, and it probably shouldn't be ours. Our standard should be higher than just I'm pleasant at work and smile at people and my friends. I should be actually doing good and occasionally doing good that requires me to make a sacrifice.
Was what Smith was writing about in this work, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, really just a secularized version of what previous sort of pre-Enlightenment generations would have derived from going to church?
Well, Smith was not much of a churchgoer. He refers often in the book to the author in nature, to God or to providence, which was the term were the terms of, you know, of his day. It's interesting to me how little he relies on God for morality. He argues that we God put in us, the author of nature put in us the judging of other people around us. He says basically God made each of us the judge of mankind, that we look around and we approve of good deeds and we disapprove of bad deeds. And that is what keeps people on the straight and narrow to some extent. But a lot of what he says is timeless wisdom. You can find it in religious writings. You can find it in great secular writings. It's what I think of as the wisdom literature, and it's eternal. We all know that money doesn't bring happiness, but it's evidently a hard lesson to learn, and learning it in a new way I think is always a good idea.
Russ Roberts is with us. He's a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and author of the new book, Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Russ Roberts. He hosts the podcast Econ Talk, and he is John and Jean Denault Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. His new book is called Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. On gratitude, Russ, I think this is really interesting. Smith, and I'm paraphrasing here, essentially says we should be grateful for every day we wake up with a clear conscience, healthy, and out of debt. Those seem like good rules even now.
Yeah, they're pretty timeless. If you've got your health, you're not in debt. And I think he had, you know, a clean conscience. He said, you know, that's most of what makes us happy is what his claim is. It's not the things that we acquire. It's not the success at work, it's not anything on the external side. It's the deep truths that still matter, and those are cliches to some extent. Again, it's very tempting to say, "Oh, there's nothing." Smith's just talking about all these classic ideas that everybody's known forever, but the hard part's to remember them. And I would argue that Smith gives us a way to get these ideas into our bones and actually behave well. And I think that's what's important. And it's a reminder. Especially this idea of loveliness, that if you can be lovely, if you can take satisfaction from knowing that you do the right thing, that can really go a long way to making your life meaningful. And that's just good advice.
With regard to the idea that money does not buy happiness, create happiness, you have to wonder if Smith was able to say this because he was, in fact, a rather wealthy person. I mean, he may have felt differently had he been struggling to keep body and soul together.
Yeah, I'm not sure he's wealthy. I'd say he's successful. By the standards of his day, he was successful and financially well off. He had a nice he had nice money coming from the Duke of Buccleuch, who he had tutored the son of that man. He had this nice cushy government job of being the customs commissioner. And so in that sense, he didn't have to worry about money very much, certainly towards the last part of his life. The early part of his life, I think he was probably not so well off. He was probably somewhat, you know, he was comfortable, but he wasn't anything close to wealthy. And certainly in his times, there were fabulously wealthy people. The modern Duke of Buccleuch supposedly is the largest private landowner in the United Kingdom. And I have read, I don't know if it's true, that his land, if it were fenced in, the fence would reach from Scotland to San Francisco. And it sounds like an exaggeration to me, but it's a long fence. So I think I'm sure even in 1759, the Duke of Buccleuch was a pretty successful guy. So Smith didn't really taste that level of prosperity himself. He also couldn't foresee the level of prosperity that would come to everyday people in the world, in much of the developed world in our time, right? We live in a time where we still have a billion people in horrible poverty, but we have unimagined numbers of people living lives that are much nicer than what the Duke of Buccleuch could imagine in Smith's day. So Smith couldn't see that. He couldn't see the lifespans that we now have regularly that are achieved for everyday people. And so I don't know if he might have tempered some of his views about wealth a little bit if he saw what it was like in our time. But I think he's really talking about the inner life that we lead and what we pay attention to and what gives us satisfaction and what motivates us. And what he was saying, which is still true, is that if we always are focusing on keeping score and making that next big sale at work, that next big success or winning that contract – if that's all we ever think about, we're really missing out on what is important in life. And that part, you know, that part is still true.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phone now. We have Tony on the line in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Hi. I got right in the middle of this. It's a fascinating topic. I just wanted to make the comment that I had worked with someone who was from a communist country who grew up without any religion whatsoever and was probably the most decent, caring, moral person I ever met in my life. And so it seems that, you know, we really don't need religion for that sort of thing. And it's part of, I guess, being human and growing up in a community. And I'll take the rest off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. You want to comment on that, Russ?
Yeah, there's no doubt that you know, there are religious people who are awful and there are non-religious people who are glorious. You know, for me, I think religion encourages mindfulness. Smith was saying that, you know, we imagine an impartial spectator who looks over our shoulder and who keeps us on the straight and narrow. And for some people, that's sufficient. For others, though, a religious life, I think, helps sometimes people pay attention to what they're doing and to hold themselves to a higher standard. What's interesting about Smith, though, is that, you know, he really says there's always someone watching. And it's not God, which is what's fascinating. It's you. And that is a way that without religion you can motivate yourself to be a lovely person. I was recently in London and I was in a room. I was waiting to give a talk and I was in a room that Adam Smith, a building that Adam Smith may have been in.
Hmm.
Which was extraordinary. I was talking at the Royal Society of Arts, and Smith had been a member of the Royal Society of Arts. I don't know if it was in that location or not, but in the room I was in the waiting room, was a chair off in the corner that said Presidential Chair 1759. And this chair had been built for the president of the Royal Society at that time, the Royal Society of Arts, that Smith was a member of. And I thought, 1759, that's when Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments was written. It's possible that Adam Smith could have sat in that chair. And I thought for a minute, maybe I should just sit in it. But there was a sign. There was a sign that said, don't sit in the chair.
Hmm.
But there was no one there. was anyone really going to see if I sat? I don't think there was any closed-circuit television. I think I could have gotten away with it and sat in Smith's chair. But I knew that Smith would have disapproved of that because even though no one was watching, I was watching. And I knew it was unlovely to sit in the chair that is not supposed to be sat in, particularly because if every guest sat in that chair, it wouldn't be there for very long. So I shouldn't contribute to that decay. I should stay out of the chair. So I settled for stroking the arm of the chair. You know, I thought, well, you know, maybe Smith touched this arm and that's nice enough.
There's no prescription on stroking the arm of the chair.
No, it didn't say anything about that. So I just went forward and it was actually impulsive. I couldn't help myself.
Well, conversely, Smith believed that the more we do engage in those acts of, I guess, self-discipline and trying to be lovely and doing what's right simply because it's right, the more we contribute to a climate where other people are encouraged to do the same.
Yeah, he really had a beautiful way of thinking about where our norms, you know, he didn't call them norms, but he thought of it as civilization and civility and propriety and the things that make it easy for people to get along with each other. And he says those norms come from us. We create those through our daily interactions with people. When we do things that are not so nice, people disapprove of them. When we do things that are honorable and selfless, people approve of them. He says those are the things that create trust, that create honor, that create civility and culture and civilization. And it's really a beautiful idea. I tell a story in the book of going to Big Sur, California, and needing to get the payment for the cabin. I was going to stay in with my wife. We had a chance to spend one night on our own away from the kids. And the landlord of the cabin said, well, you know, you can't get me the check in time, so I'll just leave the door unlocked. You just leave the money on the table. And when my cleaning lady comes in the next morning, she'll get it for me. And I thought, as an economist, I thought, you know, this is kind of a recipe for disaster. I'm leaving the money. What if the cleaning lady pretends, pockets it and says, oh, it wasn't there? What if I don't leave the money? The cleaning lady says it isn't there and the landlord blames the theft on the cleaning lady. Or third possibility, I leave the money. The cleaning lady gives it to the woman and she tells me, oh, I never got it. So I saw here's this enormous potential for problems. Well, the next morning after we'd had this great day in Big Sur, California, I fanned out a bunch of $20 bills on the breakfast table in the cabin. And I took a picture of them, which was really stupid because I could take the picture and put the money back in my pocket. But I thought at least I can show her I put it down on the table. And I walked out of that cabin thinking, I hope this goes okay. And it did. And we live in a culture in a world where people generally, not always, of course, but they're generally trustworthy. When you've got that, you don't have to constantly monitor and verify behavior. When you can trust strangers, total strangers, that's a much better world to live in. And Smith argues that world is created by our own loveliness and our own honoring of lovely people and our dishonoring of unlovely people. And that's just – it's a beautiful idea.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Austin in Dallas. Hey, Austin.
Hi, Chris. I was curious what our Adam Smith expert would think about or would comment on the case of Eddie Lampert, who was the CEO of Sears. It's a kind of – is he familiar with that subject?
I know a little bit about Sears. No, they didn't do so well. Haven't been doing very well.
Nope.
Yes. Austin, why don't you just give us a 10-second explanation of why this is you want to talk
sure.
about this?
He was a very successful financial investment guru who was elected the CEO of Sears, and he applied the sort of free market, each division compete against itself principles, and the company ran itself into the ground. You'll notice Sears has gone from being top of the line to sort of a hardly even mentioned tool warehouse. It's kind of fallen apart.
Yeah, I know about that story. I don't really think the source of it is the free market principles. And more importantly, you can't really apply free market principles to a individual company. Most companies are run from the top down, not from the bottom up. To the extent they can use bottom up and emergent behavior, they try to. But most companies have a CEO who creates rules, you know, with a board, et cetera. And Sears is in a very tough environment. I think they brought in somebody whose expertise wasn't so much in retailing, and that was the bigger problem. The point you make, though, that I do want to talk about that I think is relevant is competition. And Smith was a big fan of competition at the national level. He understood that it's really important that businesses compete against each other as a way to make to protect consumers from their natural impulses and urge to make money at your expense. And he believed that, that generally protected consumers in many situations. So Smith was a big fan of competition, but he wouldn't have, I think, been a fan of it in a small setting. In particular, I talk in the book, in my book, about how in a family, for example, we don't want to use the laws of the marketplace to motivate our kids necessarily. I don't rent my bedrooms out to my kids. I give them to them for free. When there's only one chicken leg left, I don't auction it off to the highest bidder. So I don't use markets and prices to allocate resources in my home. But for the economy at large, it works pretty well, particularly because you're dealing with strangers. So Smith was not naive about the ability of goodwill or kindness to motivate good behavior with strangers. That was his other book. That was the Wealth of Nations. The book we're talking about, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, here he says, you know, when we interact with each other one-on-one and face-to-face, it's a different set of incentives that are effective. But outside there with strangers, he's a big fan of competition.
Okay, so The Theory of Moral Sentiments was published in 1759. The Wealth of Nations came out in 1776. Would Adam Smith have assumed that folks who read The Wealth of Nations would consider it along with The Theory of Moral Sentiments, or would at least be familiar with both texts?
I think he knew that most people had read both of them. I don't think he saw them as two separate books. A lot of people in history have wondered how the same man could have written this one book that's all about self-interest and this other book that's about people doing things for other people and caring about them. And I think, again, as we were talking about a minute ago, I think he saw them as part of the same idea. The idea is that when we're dealing with people who are far away from us, we act differently than we're dealing with people who are close to us, people that we meet face to face. We're trading, we're exchanging, we're out with strangers, global trade in particular. You don't want to rely on kindness and other personal traits to motivate people. There you're going to have a different set of motivations. What's interesting is that he revised The Theory of Moral Sentiments all through his life, and they made a major revision in 1790, the year of his death. So it was really the book that was ever with him. And, you know, he's famous for The Wealth of Nations, which is a very important book. I'm a big fan of it. Never would I say anything negative about it overall. It's a fabulous book. There are things in it that are still worth reading that still have application today. But what's fascinating to me is this other book, the one we're talking about, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and that I talk about in my book, How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, because what he's trying to do there, that's so timeless. You know, The Wealth of Nations, he's got stuff in there about the silver standard. He's got stuff in there about agriculture, stuff we don't care about at all today, stuff that's not relevant. It's not relevant for England or the UK. It's not relevant for America. And yet this other book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, it's always relevant. It's about how we get along with other people, and that never gets old.
Russ Roberts is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and host of the Econ Talk podcast. His new book is called Adam Smith Can Change Your Life, An Unexpected Guide to Human Nature and Happiness. Russ, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And if you want to email the show, you can do that at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.